Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, guys, good morning. It's Sunday, the 24th of May, 2009. That makes this Solder Smoke 108. A lot of exciting stuff happening on the Solder Smoke front this week, or in the last 2 weeks. Those of you who've been watching the blog know that I've been looking at the Shuttle Hubble Space Telescope repair mission. This is STS-125. Sent the shuttle up there to work on the magnificent Hubble Space Telescope. I have a real interest in this. Like many of you, I kind of dabble in astronomy. I have a 6-inch Dobsonian Newtonian reflector here. Don't get it use it too much here in urban Rome, but it sits there in the living room. My wife wants to keep it in the living room. She says it adds character to the place, and it somehow fits. You can see I have a very understanding and sympathetic wife. She lets me keep the telescope in the living room. And Hubble is of real interest too, because when it first went up, or when they were first working on it in its early years of operation, I was in the Dominican Republic, which is about 18 degrees north of the equator, and Hubble is mostly in an equatorial orbit, so this meant that it was coming overhead where we were every 90 minutes or so. So I would be out in the front yard of my house in Santo Domingo with the telescope in the morning, and just almost every day I got a good view of Hubble passing by. It's huge. It's, you know, the size of a bus, and it's all bright shiny aluminum with big solar panels, so this thing would be coming over and I could watch it go from horizon to horizon. Great stuff. I used to like to watch Hubble fly over and then step inside and download the latest images from the telescope. It was inspirational stuff. Anyway, the astronauts were up there this week working on it, and NASA TV, I'm sure they've done this before, maybe I just haven't been paying attention, but the NASA TV coverage of this thing was really magnificent. They were using, at various points you could look through live through the helmet cams of the astronauts, and you could see, you know, pretty much as they were seeing it. I mean, you'd see the guy's hands reaching out, working on various recalcitrant bolts and screws and stuff. And the kind of work that they were doing, they were swapping out power supplies, and some of it was really sophisticated. You know, they were changing the cameras and things like that, but some of it came down to just swapping out bad power supplies, and I thought these were the kind of repairs that we can relate to. And, you know, I think this was a particularly nice and interesting crew. They seemed to really have a great kind of chemistry between them. Astronaut Massimino, I found particularly interesting because his accent puts him very close to the same area in New York that I grew up. And I checked, and in fact, he grew up on Long Island in New York. So the New York accent is still there. And it was really interesting listening to someone who sounds like he's from my old neighborhood, directing something as complicated as the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope. Also, the kind of things that they were struggling with were very familiar to us. Also, you know, they were trying to get bolts open and off of this telescope, and these bolts had been in space for I think 16 years or 19 years, and so some of them were stuck, and you know, their concerns were were the same concerns that we have at this point, guys, and that is, how much torque do you put on that baby before you strip it or chop the head right off the bolt? Now, they had a lot more information than we did, than we usually do, because they knew exactly what the breaking point was on each one of these bolts, and they also knew exactly how much torque their special electric wrench was applying. So a couple times they were about ready to give up, and then they said, well, give it another shot and crank it up a bit, and they did, and then you'd hear this kind of triumphant, yay, we got it, it's moving. One of the guys who was working on it had spent years as a working as an auto mechanic, and when he got one of the unstuck bolts, when he got one of the stuck bolts unstuck, I heard him say something like, wow, it's just like removing a head bolt on an engine or something like that. So three cheers for the crew of STS 125. They definitely all have knack potential, and they did a great job fixing the amazing telescope. I put up on the blog some articles about this and some pictures, and I also put up a short video of the personal backgrounds, the childhoods, and the educational experiences of each of the astronauts. I found it inspirational stuff. It's great stuff, great kind of thing to show to kids, to show them how if they get on the right path, they can go to very high places indeed. So I showed it to Billy, and I'm going to show it to Maria. And if any of you out there have kids of the appropriate age, I'd recommend having them take a look at the video. It's very entertaining, interesting, and inspirational. Another kind of inspirational thing that came my way related to this STS-125 mission was a picture of the shuttle and the telescope. I think just prior to their actually joining up, the picture was taken by an amateur photographer, a French amateur photographer who's living in Florida. It was sent to me by Matthew in Spokane. Thank you, Matthew. But what this guy did was he just did some calculations and used some software to determine when the two spacecraft would be in front of the sun from his location in Florida. And then he set up his cameras and his telephoto lens, and he waited, and at the appropriate moment he started clicking, and he captured the two spacecraft as they flew in front of the sun. And it's quite an interesting picture. I put it up on the blog. Check it out. And thanks again to Matthew, and congratulations to the intrepid amateur photographer who took that shot. It's always fun to find something that inventive from somebody who's not doing it professionally, just an amateur just like us. All right, let's see. Whisper, guys. I'm going to talk to you some more about Whisper. Those of you who are kind of had it with Whisper, my apologies, but I'll try to keep it related to more conventional, traditional, mainstream QRP knack pursuits. I think you like this, though. I got into Whisper largely as a result of an article written by Gene W3PM. Gene put on the web by his design for a really simple kind of minimalist Whisper rig. It's basically just a on the transmit side, it's a QRP transmitter. Built for a single frequency. That's you don't really need to move the frequency around. So Gene's design is a bit unusual in that it's not like your standard SSB transmitter. He has the you have the audio coming out of the computer from the Whisper program designed by Joe Taylor, and so you've got your audio frequency signal coming out. And Gene has it going through an audio amplifier. I think he uses a couple of op amps or dual op amp. And then it goes up to a diode ring mixer. I think he uses an SBL-1. I ended up with an SBL-3 after frying the SBL-1 that the Jim AL7RV sent me. But And then from the mixer, this is the kind of unusual part. He has the crystal filter at the operating frequency. The crystal filter at 10.140200 megahertz or so, and uses that to chop off the other sideband. So obviously you're not going to do a whole lot of frequency variation with this kind of rig. Now, I made it a lot simpler. I made mine double sideband. I got rid of the crystal filter, and I was too lazy to build another audio amplifier, so I just used the audio amplifier from an old computer speaker. Anyway, I've got the thing running, and I was exchanging emails with Gene as I was going through the construction process on this rig, and at one point he said, look, I'm going to be away for a while. I might not be responding to emails, but I'll talk to you later, and off he went. Okay, well, this week I get an email from Gene, and I find out where he was. He was on vacation up in Scotland near Aberdeen, and he was kind enough to tell me that when he was up there, he had a rig with him, and he had the Whisper software, and he fired it up, and sure enough, he was able to detect. I don't know if he was actually able to hear it, but he was able to see on the screen my Whisper signal, my little 20 milliwatt Whisper signal, flying out of Rome and flying all across Europe and reaching him up there in Scotland. So I thought that was kind of cool. The guy who inspired the rig gets built in Rome. The guy goes on vacation in Scotland and hears the direct results of his inspirational article. So thanks, Gene. Thanks for the inspiration, the schematic, the ideas, and the signal report. Great. You know, guys, there's a bit of a divide in the QRSS low power community. We don't want to make too much of it because many of us operate in kind of both, I guess you could call them sub modes, but there's the guys who do visual QRSS and then there's the Whisper guys. And I started out in visual, and this is, you've heard probably more than you want to hear about my adventures with QRSS, regular QRSS, frequency shift keying QRSS, the sad tale of my upside down frequency shift keying, referred to by one radio amateur as laundry hanging out on the line. But anyway, when I went to Whisper, I modified my rig in such a way that I could easily go back to visual. Because visual, it's got a real charm to it. You see your signal there on the grabber, and you know you get to design it and play with it, so it gives it a real kind of personal stamp. So you have your own, you know, unique visual characteristics there. Guys have done some really inventive stuff with this. Johan has a bicycle going across the screen. People have put aliens in there. It's great fun. I didn't know how much I would like Whisper. And I thought, well, I'll do Whisper for a while, then I'll go back to visual. Well, I went back to visual this week, but I only stayed there for about a day, and I found myself drawn back to Whisper. And I think, well, I know why I find Whisper so interesting. With the visual, you've only got a few grabbers out there, and they're great. They're doing wonderful service for the community. It's really interesting. And as I've told you, it's great fun for me to whip out my BlackBerry as I'm riding in a bus in Rome and look on the screen and see my little upside-down FSK signal scrolling across Johan ON5EX's visual grabber. But, you know, with Whisper, you've got a whole lot more receiving stations. I mean, on a typical morning, I'll walk in. I mean, I don't cross the Atlantic every day with the 20 milliwatts and no sunspots. No, I don't cross the Atlantic every day. I have not yet crossed the Indian or Pacific Oceans. Crossed the Atlantic a few times, but every single day, every time I fire this up, there's at least a dozen European stations that have received my signal and have logged the signal reports, and there's this very appealing map with this kind of rays emitting from Rome, kind of in a fan-like arrangement, everything from stations out in the Ukraine, across Scandinavia, down many stations in the UK, a number of stations in France, Spain, Portugal, and all the way down. Usually there's some spots from the Canary Islands. So great fun there, and I knew that I would like Whisper because of the map display and the many stations out there. So I'm sorry to say that Whisper, the Whispers, the lure of the Whispers are pulling me away from the visual mode. But I think I found a way that might pull me back into visual, and that's I want to play around a bit with this mode called Slow Hell. Talk about a mode that needs a name change, guys. Yeah, I'd like to get into some of that slow hell. Hellscriber, of course, but Hellscriber really slow. And I downloaded some of the software. I haven't gotten a chance to play with it yet, but it seems ideally suited for my modified rig, the rig that I'm using on visual. I could just move the frequency and back down into the visual mode and transmit some low hell. Who knows? I might be able to come up with some creative designs, or at least see my call sign in written form scrolling across Johan's screen. All right, so that's enough for a Whisper. As long as we're talking about software, though, I want to talk to you guys. I mentioned this before. Ubuntu. I'm told not Ubuntu, Ubuntu. We've got to give it the correct pronunciation. And, you know, I usually, let's face it, I've pretty much been clear about this. I'm not fond of new software. I think I'm getting into the old buzzard mode on this thing. But, you know, every time I try to fire up something new, I struggle with it and suffer with it. And it doesn't seem to work out very well. But I recently got into, as I've been trying to get the kids' computer going, I have been getting into the use of this new Linux software, Ubuntu. And I just wanted to share with you guys. I put this up on the blog. And I'm looking at the other computer here. But Ubuntu, it's one of the many flavors or varieties of Linux. It's free. It's I found it very easy to install. One of the things that's got going for it is this kind of African cool factor. It's hard to describe, but it's developed by a fellow from South Africa, who, by the way, became one of the first space tourists and flew in space. And he's tried to keep an African theme to it. And I think Ubuntu, in one of the African languages, means like sharing with humanity. It's a very kind of altruistic, very open source Linux kind of word. But for the various 2.0, 3.0, for the various versions or editions of Ubuntu, they come up with different African-themed names. And I just want to share some of these with you. They'll give you a sense of what we're talking about here. I think the first one, 4.1, was the Warty Warthog. 5.0, Hoary Hedgehog. 5.1, the Breezy Badger. Then we had Dapper Drake. Then we had the Edgy Eft, followed by the Feisty Fawn. 7.1 was Gutsy Gibbon. 8.04 was the Hardy Heron. One of my favorites, 8.1, the Intrepid Ibex. I'm currently using version 9.04, the Jaunty Jackalope. And Billy is very anxious to get the next version loaded up, which is due out in October 2009. A really cool name, Karmic Koala. All right. That's Ubuntu. I really like it. They've got some really wonderful ham programs there. It's amazing. You go to the repository where all the free software is sitting there waiting for you, and there's all kinds of really interesting ham radio programs. I got the satellite tracking program running up there, all kinds of programs for PSK and RTTY, all great stuff. And there's a version of this thing that you could put on one of these memory sticks, a small version of Ubuntu called Easy Peasy. We got it on the stick, and we fired it up, and Billy's able to run it on his little Asus netbook EPC computer. So very cool. And three cheers for Ubuntu. Speaking of computer geeks, speaking of computer stuff, I have up on the blog, somebody sent me a link to a guy out there. I think he's in Alaska or he's on the West Coast. He's one of a group. I had been unaware of these folks. This is a kind of a they're related to they've got an illness that's sort of related to the knack. You'll recognize this kind of madness here. These are called the Time Nuts. Time Nuts. And they are they're really into really, really, really accurate time measurement. And this one guy has set up a number of cesium clocks. He's got one of the most accurate time measurement facilities in the country out in his garage. And the site that was sent to me that I put up on the blog involves an experiment that he did in which he loaded up the family minivan with a number of cesium clocks and then took the cesium clocks and his three kids up onto Mount Rainier and stayed up there for a while. And he had calculated beforehand that being at higher altitude would cause the clocks to run slower or faster. I think it's slower than the clocks that stayed down at lower altitude. This is all Einstein's general theory of relativity and time dilation and all that. I think he calculated that the difference would be 20 microseconds. And then when he came back, lo and behold, 20 microseconds was observed. So there's all kinds of pictures. He did it in a very very humorous way. I enjoyed reading the article. And it's up there on the blog. Check it out. Be careful. You guys might slip into time nut nactum. Get a great email this week from Jonathan, KB1KIX. He alerted me. I thought we had found all of the Gene Shepherd ham radio shows. Wrong. I was wrong. We missed a big one. And this thing, I mean, a really, really great Gene Shepherd ham radio show. From January 7th, 1964, on WOR in New York, Gene Shep describes getting his Class A ham radio ticket, what it was like to take the exam, what he had to do, how he studied for it, and the excitement of getting the license, and the sense of achievement that it gave to just a teenage kid. I guess Gene was probably about 13 or 14 when he got the ticket, but you know, he talked about how rewarding it was to get something that many adults found very difficult to obtain. But then he also talks about how totally clueless, or almost totally clueless, his school was regarding his achievement, and he was on the verge of being left back because of well, he had kind of let his academic work slip as he focused, appropriately, of course, on the Class A license. But then, well, there's a surprising ending there, and I'll leave it to you. There are YouTube links on the blog page at soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and you can just click on them, and you get part one and part two. And I think you'll really enjoy it. It really resonates with anyone who really has the knack and has been into this game for a while. It also, I think, will be interesting for newcomers. Hey, take a listen, Shep. It's always a lot of fun. Not for everybody. I mean, he's a bit of an acquired taste. He's kind of an edgy New Yorker, frankly, and he gets on some folks' nerves. But I think you'll really like this one. Let's see, I got an email from somebody who said that, now I know why you do this solder smoke business. You want to be Gene Shepherd. And I wouldn't take it that far. Gene is the master. No one can aspire, that high, but, But he's certainly an influence, and I think he's the guy who got me into ham radio, so sure. What can I say? Excelsior. All right. This brings us, Gene Shepherd. Yes, this is a good way to talk about this. Let's talk about Solder Smoke, the book. Because Gene Shepherd's in the book. We got his picture, a number of quotes, the story about how he got me into ham radio. The book is available. It's selling quite nicely, and I hope to get back some feedback from people. So if you're reading the book, please shoot me an email. Let me know what you think. Don't worry about hurting my feelings. If you don't like it, let me know. If you like it, let me know. If you got suggestions for improvement, please pass them along. But I'm really pleased to have the book out. You know, this is the second book that I've written. The first book, I think I mentioned this. The first book had nothing to do with radio. It was a very serious book about a very difficult time in Central America, and it wasn't a whole lot of fun to write. And frankly, that first book is not the kind of book that I would recommend anybody take to the beach with them in the summer. It's not really light reading. It's kind of heavy stuff. It's war and violence and all that heartache. So anyway, when I wrote that first book, glad I wrote it, got it done. I like the writing process, and it's very rewarding to get your book published, especially if it's published by a prestigious publisher, and you go through that whole process, and it's the published author thing. And hey, I liked it. I admit it. That book was published by Naval Institute Press. They're a small publisher, but a prestigious publisher. Those are the guys who discovered Tom Clancy. That's their big claim to fame. They're right there at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. That's another important claim to fame. So I was really delighted to have my first book published with them. But to tell you the truth, I'm having more fun. I've had a lot more fun with this second book. It's Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. And let me tell you about it. It is the kind of book that you should stick under your arm and take to the beach this summer, because it's designed to be fun. It's supposed to be fun and funny and kind of the opposite of the heavy stuff that was in my first book. But it's not just kind of funny stories from my life as an expatriate geek, as an expat radio amateur operator. It's got elements in it that I hope will be educational, and it'll make it kind of technically worthwhile to stick this book under your arm as you head off to the beach this summer. And what I've done is, well, I start out by saying, look, I'm not a technical expert. I'm not a trained engineer. I'm completely an amateur at this. But over the years, I have struggled to understand various bits of radio and electronic theory. A lot of it I found fairly easy to understand, but at a number of critical points, I got really stuck and just couldn't for the life of me figure out why this circuit or this component was doing what it was doing. And I really wanted to understand, and as I describe in the book, one of the reasons I really wanted to understand was, I guess, the influence of guys like Gene Shepherd. And when I listened to the stories of Gene Shepherd as a kid, he described radio amateurs and becoming a radio amateur as like an almost, I don't know, kind of a spiritual thing, something that important. I mean, and to be a true radio amateur, you really had to understand the circuitry. This is very apropos of the segments, the YouTube segments that I just described, because he talked about how, as part of his Class A exam, the thing that he had to do was, in front of the examiner, draw out the entire schematic, including parts values, for an AM modulated tube type transmitter, and also provide waveforms. So obviously what they were testing at that point, and I don't think they do this anymore, frankly, what they were testing for was understanding. They wanted to make sure that the people who were getting those licenses really understood the circuitry at a fairly deep level. So anyway, this was kind of the ham radio ethos that I was exposed to when I was brought into the hobby. And I always had this feeling that unless I really understood the circuitry that I was working on, well, I was, you know, kind of a borderline appliance operator. The other influence I had as a kid is when I got into radio in the early 1970s, this was at the time of the CB, Citizens Band Radio rage. And because of that, ham radio operators, especially, you know, like 73 Magazine, established and encouraged a real kind of cultural divide between the great unwashed, the masses of, you know, CB guys and true radio amateurs. And what distinguished us as radio amateurs was understanding that we really knew what the circuitry was all about. We were not appliance operators. We were not just somebody who had plunked down $25 for a radio and then got on there and jabbered and used all that CB talk. I mean, of course, the distinction was overdone, and many folks started out in CB and then became ham radio operators, and of course, that's great. But again, I guess because of the time that I got into the hobby, there was this ethos of, well, you need to understand, and if you don't really understand it, then you're kind of a borderline appliance operator, or worse yet, kind of a CBer. So, anyway, I've always wanted to try to understand the circuitry, and you know, a lot of times the literature, like the ARRL handbook, it's a handbook. It's mostly just to provide kind of facts and kind of cookbook circuits and parts values to get rigs working, and they very often don't get into the understanding bit of it very well. So what I've tried to do with this book is, in the course of talking about my life as a teenage ham radio operator in New York and then later in various places around the world that my work took me, I pause in each chapter, sometimes two or three times in each chapter, and talk about, okay, look, this is what I was struggling to understand at this time. What is an electron, really? What is it? And what is a radio wave? How can we really understand what a radio wave is? What is this thing that we shoot out of our antenna? How does it do that? How does it work? What's that all about? How does an RF choke or an RF transformer work? How does it transform impedance and change values of voltage and current? What's the role of special relativity in there? How does a capacitor really work? How does a capacitor block DC but allow AC to pass? How does a bypass capacitor work? What's the basis of all that? Modulation, what is it? How do we produce sidebands in an AM signal? How do we produce double sideband? How do mixers work? Why do we say that mixers multiply but then produce sum and difference frequencies? What's that all about? And why do you need nonlinearity in a mixer? Why? All these kind of why questions that I'm sure many electronics instructors find terribly annoying. But anyway, I was involved in many cases with long struggles with these topics just to understand. I don't know if I've worked it all out. I don't know if I've worked it all out correctly. But anyway, I've kind of described these struggles, and they're included in the book. So I hope that those portions of the book make this kind of more than entertainment. I hope they make it educational also. I also wanted to infuse the book with inspiration, because that's one thing that people, when they write in about solder smoke, they say that they really like the podcast because they find it inspirational. So I've tried to include a lot of inspiration in there. And we've got quotes from Isaac Asimov, from Feynman, from Ashar Farhan, from Cliff Stoll, from Clinton DeSoto, from Albert Einstein, from Steve Wozniak. There's poetry in this book, poetry related to radio and the knack. There's quotes from Joe Taylor and Thomas Edison. It's not just about radio, it's almost mostly radio, but there's also discussions of rockets, rocket photography, kites, kite cams, kite aerial photography, and occasional discussion of astronomy. There's the story of the Solder Smoke podcast, where it came from, how Mike and I created it. I think you'll like the book. It's right now it's only available from the Lulu website, www.lulu.com. The link to it is up on the Blogspot page. It's I want to point out it's available around the world. Lulu is a really good company, and they have printing plants in Europe. They have a printing plant in the UK, and I think they have another one in Spain. So if you place the order, they will take euros, they will take British pounds, they'll take other currencies also, and they will ship to ship around the world. And I think they're particularly good at shipping very quickly to the UK and to the rest of the European Union, but also to Asia and to Australia. So I think just about wherever you are, you can get the book. And the reason I'm keeping it up on Lulu right now and not putting it out on Amazon is that it's easier to keep it reasonably priced by doing this. Eventually, I'll put it out on Amazon, but for now, I'm going to keep it on Lulu. And so, anyway, that's the story of the book. Enough of that now. We got a special report this week, guys. We got a special report from our man in Dayton. You know, last weekend was 4 days in May in the Dayton Ham Fest, and Bob, W8SX, was there as our correspondent. Bob has sent in a really excellent series of interviews. He spoke to Jan G0BBL about SDR, work on the SDR radios. He interviewed George Dobbs, G3RJV. George talked about a build-a-thon that took place in Dayton, focused on the Sudden Receiver. Built one myself. Wonderful rig. Thanks to George for that. Bob talked to Dick Pasco, G0BPS, about the organization of FDIM and the HamFest. He spoke to David NM0S about Class E amplifiers. He talked to Diz, W8DIZ, about the Flying Pigs QRP Club. You know, and the origin of the word Flying Pigs, I had it wrong. I thought it had something to do with, you know, QRP and when pigs fly. You'll find out in this interview that the origin is quite different, and it actually has to do with the famed city Porkopolis. He also, I got a real kick about Diz's comments about the rules that they follow at the Flying Pigs QRP Club and the rather stringent requirements for membership. Listen in, you'll see what I'm talking about. There's a great interview with Jim, K8IQY, and with Oleg, RV3GM, about QRP in Russia. Oleg is the guy who invented 72. And then finally, there's an interview with Ed Hare, W1RFI, of the ARRL Labs. And in the interview, I was glad to hear that Zach Lau is still on the job. Haven't heard much from Zach. I know he had some health problems a while back, but I was really pleased to hear that Zach is still on the job. I come across his articles very often, and there's a guy who's made a tremendous contribution to the hobby. Anyway, let's go to the interviews now, and then we'll be back right after the interviews.
Hello, my name is Jan Verduin. Call sign is G0BBL, call 0 Bravo Bravo Lima. And I held a talk this afternoon on the subject of soft rock development. Basically, we've been working as a team with supporting Tony Parks, KB9YIG, who's been kitting the soft rock series of kits. We helped Tony to develop the RX TX transceiver, 1-watt transceiver board. This was in 2009. This was followed up with the development of a synthesizer board using the SI570 synthesizer chip. And as a result of that, the RX TX and later on the receiver basically became an all-band coverage affair. Lately, we've been working with Tony on development of the Softrock 9 receiver board. For that, we've been developing a VHF plug-in a converter, and also an LF, a low-frequency converter board. As I say, it's just a part of a team. There's many people who are supporting the soft rock development. You know, our part is just a small part towards the overall contribution.
Okay. How many people are involved on average?
The QRP 2000 team is five people. There is Alan, M0PUB, who basically does development of the Power SDR, the Flex Radio Power SDR software, together with Guido, PE1NNZ. Guido is making the DLL available to support SoftRock using the Power SDR application. The third person in the team is John Law, G8BTR. John has been developing all the PCBs that we use in our prototypes. The fourth member is Tom Beyer, DG8SAQ. He wrote the original AVR firmware, which was published in an article in QEX, I think it was in January, February 2008. I myself, my task is generally the hardware design. I draw the schematics and basically talk with Tony on you know, anything that is useful for the development of his kits.
Okay. Thank you. Are you having a good time here?
We are having an excellent time here, yes. It's good to see so many people and getting all the reactions and getting new ideas. It's really, you know, excellent to be at the FDIM.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Hi, I'm Dick Pascoe. I'm G0BPS and, for my sins, president of this organization. And we're here at the Holiday Inn in Fairbourne, near Dayton, for Hamvention, and more importantly, for 4 days in May. Fantastic weekend.
And how's it turning out so far?
Surprisingly, considering the financial conditions throughout the world, I think that numbers are up. People are spending a little bit more money than they have done in the past. And without a doubt, people are enjoying themselves this weekend. And we're only on the second day, so there's tomorrow to go yet.
I'm surprised how much money I see change hands in there.
I've been astounded at the amount of money that people have been spending. Whether it's a combination of to hell with it, we're going to go out and enjoy ourselves, or whether people are genuinely not in recession, it's difficult to tell. But one thing I can say, I'm enjoying myself so much this weekend.
Great. Did you enjoy the talks?
Very much. It's not always my opportunity to listen to every talk, but because I was the moderator this year, I had to be there the whole time. And some of them went over my head, as probably several other people said. Majority of them I really enjoyed. And what many people may not know is that I'm the guy that gets these speakers to come along here. And it's by my invitation and my choice who actually does the speaking.
I didn't know that.
Not many people do know that. But through my years of coming to the US and all my other travels, I've got to know personally a huge number of the hams, and some of the prominent hams who've been able to put a lot into the hobby, and a lot of them that I call friends. I won't name any. It'd be unfair to pick some of them out of the hat. But at least two of the speakers today are personal friends.
That's great. Okay. Anything else you want to sum up?
Well, this is my last year here at Dayton for a while. My last year as president. And we've had a superb team. No single person can run an organization like this. It's all down to team effort. And if you've got a team behind you, as I've had, then everything just slots in and works so sweetly. It's been a real privilege to lead this organization over the last 5 years. I'm going to leave it in very, very good hands. And I'm going to enjoy sitting back and just seeing how it goes over the next few years. and I have no trepidation. I know, I just know that it's going to succeed.
Marvelous. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, George Dobbs, GCRJV, speaking to you from 4 days in May at Dayton. The thing I thought I'd talk about was the Build-a-thon, which was held last night. And about 30 people came into the room, some of whom had never even soldered before, and the exercise was to build a Sutton. The Sutton receiver was 20 years old this year, and we built it Manhattan style, and they all started work at 4 o'clock, and I joined them then, and I left them at 9:45. But by that time, everybody except for three had built a Sutton, and we'd heard stations on 40 meters. The other three were able to go through them later, and we got those to work as well. So 30 people actually heard stations on something they built with their own hands, most of them for the first time. And it was a pleasure. I was tired at the end because it was a long time, but it was a pleasure to see people building something for the first time. And build-a-thons are beginning to grow, as you all know, and so I can only say that it's something very worthwhile. It's a source of pleasure for them and a source of pleasure for all of those who help them build. And we're going to try one at the Rochdale Convention at the end of this year.
Can you tell us what the Sutton receiver consists of in terms of active devices?
Well, the Sutton is a fairly basic direct conversion circuit. It's an NE602 or 612 and an LM386. And it's roughly what happened if you threw those two chips in the air and they fell down. So it's absolutely standard. But it works amazingly well. We were listening to stations on 40 meters on a clip lead clipped onto a solder station. And everybody heard stations on 40 meters.
Great. Everybody had a good time then.
Yeah, it's a good way to bring people towards building things. One of the sort of problems for people, well, it's twofold. First of all, people often choose a project that is just outside of their grasp and then fail at the first hurdle and then don't ever want to build again. And the other thing is it can turn into a building by numbers thing. If you just get a printed circuit board with a silk screen on top which tells you where to poke the parts. And building it Manhattan style was a real joy because then they were seeing that you didn't have to have an X board. They were choosing some of the routes for their parts, and they were choosing how to mount them. And it was a good exercise in being able to translate from a circuit on a paper into something they built on a board.
Great. Thank you. Okay. My name is David Kripe. Call is NM0S. My presentation this morning at FDIM was Class E power amplifiers for QRP. Class E is a mode of operation of a power amplifier that allows efficiency that is not attainable through any other mode of power amplifier. It uses very inexpensive power supply MOSFETs to achieve efficiencies exceeding 90%. So despite the many advantages that this mode has, it's been very underutilized by hams. And so the presentation this morning was talking about some very simple cookbook approaches to designing them with the ultimate goal of having this technology more widespread by QRP community. So
So what happens is apparently that if you have greater efficiency, smaller batteries.
Indeed. With so many of the hams now looking at portable operations, battery-powered operation, increasing efficiency from the nominal 50%, which is pretty par for most transmitters now, to 90%, has a measurable improvement in battery life. And so in many senses, you could consider this to be a green technology, improving the energy efficiency of something that's already not using much power to begin with.
Great. And you expect this to be used in, is it used in other equipment, and will it be used in the ham equipment, you think?
It's used in a number of different industries, all the way from cell phones and broadcast transmitters, but been very underutilized within the ham community. So it's really my goal and my aim to popularize this and bring it to the forefront so that other people can experiment with it and use it in their own transmitters.
And you provided some nice equations, simple equations, to do some simple designs.
Simple as I could make them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
One gig.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Well, my name is Dieter Genso. Most folks call me Diz. Call is W-A-D-I-Z. And got a license in 1973 as a novice. And about 6 months later, I thought we'd upgrade a little bit and went straight to the advanced. Didn't have enough code proficiency, of course, so they had to go for the extra back in those days. So we played with ham radio for quite a while and enjoyed the heck out of that. As typical hams, you know, got in and out of the hobby over the years and really got back into it in the late 90s. And then in 1999, there's a thing called the Ellicraft receiver that was being engineered. There was a lot of hoopla going on the web. And I was kind of interested in it because it kind of fit my personal niche, you know, what I thought a radio might be. So I started following that radio and got familiar with the QRPL and the Ellicraft list and all the QRPers. And that kind of got me hooked and got me more into the radio. So one day, I'm looking and decided that maybe we should have a QRP club in Cincinnati. And, of course, we didn't have one. This was August 9th, 1999. So I sent out an email and on QRPL and soliciting for membership and for other members in the Cincinnati area. And I got two emails back, and the significant one was from one guy, and he says, well, there's me. That's all the email said. And that was from WB6JBM. His name is Rick, or better known as Slash Rick. So he and I got together over the phone, internet, email. And Rick had a server, internet server. So this was kind of nice because we can develop a web page, and we did so. And all of a sudden we had Flying Pig number one and Flying Pig number two. Oh, by the way, the Flying Pig thing, that name, in case you're interested, came from the Flying Pigs, which was synonymous with Cincinnati. Cincinnati used to be called Porkopolis. And there's some Flying Pig statues downtown where the pork butchers used to hang out. So anyway, we picked that name. It kind of made sense to us. And from then on, we started soliciting a couple of members. And of course, we got some members locally immediately. 6-7 members. We had Dan N8IE, who was a significant member. Matt, what's Matt? I think Matt was pig number 4. I can't remember all these numbers. So we went on and on. And now 10 years later, we've got about 2,300, give or take, members all over the world. We are international and having a good old time. So.
And the dues are?
And the dues are, let's see, anything you want to pay, or if you're really destitute, we'll let you in for free. Membership requirements, the last I saw, I don't think it's changed any. It's still 20, you have to be living 12,000 nautical miles from Greater Cincinnati, Ohio. And I don't think we had any problems with anybody complaining about those that distance.
And the meetings occur?
Meetings occur, well, they're kind of continuous. They're perpetual. We hang out on the net mostly. Of course, we have the normal events in Ohio. Some of the guys will always go to the field day. We participate with field day regularly. We used to do the bumblebees, freeze your butt off, some of the archy contests, a lot of field events. We were actually very, very active in the beginning years. We've kind of died off a little bit. Some of us moved out of town or what have you. Situations change, but we're still a very active group and have a good time, have a lot of fun.
And the rules for the club.
The rules are no rules, damn it. That's the beauty of it. We have no officers. We collect no money. No rules whatsoever. Just fun.
sounds like a great organization.
And if we can't fix it, you can't. You read the website, flyingpigsfpqrp.com.
Okay. Thank
good
you.
Enough? Is that good enough?
Yes.
Cool.
Okay, it's going.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jim Kirchy, KIQY from Fenton, Michigan. And I'm down here at FDIM doing another lookabout with all of the folks here that are in QRP. I just got back a week and a half ago from OzarkCon, where I was a presenter and talked about the 212 project from its beginning back in 1997 when Wayne Burdick proposed that design contest all the way through the new NorCal 212XX commercial rigs that are a derivative of that. Thoroughly enjoyed the presentations today that were put on, particularly the one by Rick Campbell, KK7B. Rick's one of my real heroes because his mindset and my mindset are kind of the same thing. Keep it simple and teach people how to solder and how to build things with a handful of parts and create something useful and learn a lot along the way. Let's see, what else? Kick it off.
Go ahead.
George Dobbs spoke this morning, and everything that George says is kind of cool bits of wisdom, it seems like. He's got a great sense of humor, and regardless of what George is talking on, it's always very interesting and always very entertaining. The other presentation that was most interesting to me was the Class E power amplifiers for QRP that Dave Kripe, NM0S, talked about. I've not had any experience building those or playing with them, and I thought it was very interesting, particularly the fact that he had fairly simplified design equations available so that those of us who have no experience could take a whack at that and try our hand at building a few of those. So, looking forward to tonight with the vendors, and last night we played bluegrass for about 2.5 hours. We're probably going to get together and play again tonight for 2 or 3 hours, and again tomorrow night, and coming down to Dayton and picking bluegrass music with my friends from this part of the world is as much fun as the ham radio stuff. So, those of you who have not had a chance to get to FDIM, put it on your schedule sometime and come down and enjoy it, because it's really first-class ham convention edition, if you will. Take care.
73.
My name is Oleg. Call sign is RV3GM, Radio Victor 3, Golf Mike. I'm from Lipetsk City in Russia.
And you gave a talk about...
I gave a talk about the QRP activity in Russia, the history about ex-USSR and new Russia QRP activity and events.
And do you have a club there in Russia for the QRP club? And how big is it?
The Russian QRP club is not so biggest. The current membership list includes 220 members from Russia, Europe countries, Asia, North America, and the Oceania.
And do you have outings, or where you go out and transmit from the field, or in a remote location?
Yes, we have from 5 to 6 QRP expeditions, QRPeditions inside Russia every year, very often.
Okay. Thank you, Oleg. You want to say anything else?
I wish to everybody. To everybody, readers of the magazine, a good luck, interesting QRP contacts, good health, and hope to meet you at QRP frequencies.
Thank you. Oleg is the one who initiated the idea of
signing off 72 rather than 73 to indicate QRP. Is that correct?
Maybe so. Okay. It really so. Yes, it was in 1980, for my mind, 1989. I suggested 72 code to use in QRP context only. For my surprise, the World QRP Federation is applied these suggestions, and we use 72 code for now.
That's how I sign off every time.
And you too. Thank you for attention. AB3GM signing off and QSY.
I'm Ed Hare, W1RFI, from the ARRL lab, here at the QRP 4 Days in May event. I gave a presentation on ARRL's product review process. We started with explaining how we select radios for product review, how we select the reviewers, the steps that we use to purchase the equipment, then how we run it through the lab and do the testing, and ultimately how that gets written up and put into the magazine.
And you might comment on whether this is a good time or a great job to have?
Oh, this is an absolutely great job to have, although I'll have to point out I'm the lab dad. I'm not the gentleman that actually does the testing any longer. We hired Bob Allison, WB1GCM, who now does the product review testing. So he says it's a job that he absolutely loves. In fact, he looks forward to coming to work every day. I'll talk to him in a couple of years and see how he still likes it.
That's great. And you get to interact with people like Zach Lowe.
Absolutely.
It must be a real pleasure.
Oh, yeah, Zach's absolutely a wonderful man to have around. Zach, he's our technical resource in the lab. He knows quite a bit about nearly every aspect of amateur radio technology, from the engineering down to the practical. So we're very glad to have Zach. We have in the lab Mike Gruber, W1MG, who does a lot of our RFI work. You might think it's me because of my call, but I pass that on as well. My work lately has been doing a lot of work with the FCC, with industry, and with our resource team in Washington to help defend amateur spectrum.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope that that sticks.
All right. Hey, Bob, W8SX, thanks very much for sending in those wonderful reports. Really great. Makes us feel like I was there. All right. Now it's time for...
Time for... Solder smoke mailbag.
That's awesome.
Indeed.
Yeah, solder smoke mailbag. You know, guys, I mispronounce things here. Travel around the world. I'm exposed to a lot of different foreign cultures and stuff, but every once in a while, some of these... some of the names, I'm sorry, I mangled them. And I'm sorry I mangled PE1CQP's name. I kept calling him Jupe. And a number of guys, mostly from the UK, have written in and said, nope, it's not Jupe. It's more like Yope. So anyway, sorry about that, Yope. And I'll try to get it right next time. I really enjoyed our discussions on the mixers and the balanced modulators and all that. Speaking of sudden receivers, Jeff, KO7M, the guy with the fantastic Piper Cub that was talking to us about operating aeronautical mobile a while back, Jeff, at the same time, around the same time that they were doing sudden receivers in Dayton, out there on the left coast, Jeff was building his own version of the sudden receiver, and it was his first Manhattan project. First Manhattan-style construction project. He sent a picture, and I put the picture up on the blog. Check it out. Welcome to Manhattan, Jeff. I don't think you'll ever be returning to other styles of PC board construction. The guy who does the music for the intro at Solder Smoke podcast is Mark, W8MOJ, Moj Johnson. Moj has sent in... He sent me this really interesting article. You know, we've been talking about ET's phone home rig, ET phone home and all that. It was related to QRP, QRSS, beacon transmitters, and we've had pictures of it up. I really didn't know that the real ET phone home rig that we saw in the movie ET was actually designed by a radio amateur. Now, Mark... Moj sent me this article from the April. Let me get it here. Hold on. I'll give you the right date. It's from the April 1983 issue of 73 magazine about how E.T. really called home. Now, my April Fool alarm detector was functioning, and when I saw the April dateline on this thing, I said, oh, man, Mohd is trying to get me. This is a revenge, a revenge operation. But no, it's for real. And the article is by Henry Feinberg at K2SSQ. Henry's a well-known radio amateur. I think he's with Amateur Radio Newsline also. But he was working for Bell Labs, and he had worked for worked with Don Herbert, TV's Mr. Wizard. And so when Spielberg and his studio needed somebody to design a plausible beacon transmitter for ET, they turned to Henry, K2SSQ, and he was the one who came up with the design. The article discusses how he chose the various components that ET used to phone home, and there is real technical plausibility in there. Anyway, I put a little piece up about this on the blog, including the kind of the block diagram of the ET phone home transmitter. Check it out; I'll think you'll like it. Thanks very much for that, Moj, and thanks again for the music. Really like that. Russ wrote in about crystals and whether real radio amateurs use store-bought crystals. Russ heard me mention that I was buying crystals, and he kind of insinuated that makes me an appliance operator. He recently came across a kit for rolling your own crystals. I put it up on the blog, but hey, Russ, it's a kit, man. Real radio amateurs don't use kits like that. They go out and get their own blocks of quartz, you know, and make their own rocks. All right, there you go. Thanks for that, Russ. Graham, G3ZOD, a very active guy in QRSS, sent me a screenshot of my whisper signal, and it was very nice to see what my whisper signal looks like at the other end. So I put that up on the blog. Thanks very much, Graham. Stefan, ON1AQC, wrote in about the Virtual Institute of Applied Science with lots of free ebooks online. Check it out. Just Google them. Virtual Institute of Applied Science. Thanks for that, Stefan. Thad, the AJ8T, provided some links to Gene W8PM's, W3PM's whisper rigs. And I'll try to get that up on the blog. But Gene's got a lot of designs up there for various whisper rigs. Our friend Nigel, M0NDE, our man there in Dover, who we had on a few episodes back, talks about the activities of the Dover Radio Club. They've acquired an Icon Pro 3 for the club, and it's in a very cool tower location, up in the tower of the Dover Grammar School. Very fine business location. G3ROO has constructed an 80-160-meter dipole for the station. And Nigel and the club are getting ready in early July for an event, a cross-channel event, commemorating the Bleriot flight, the first cross-channel airplane flight. And they'll be on the air, and he hopes that that Solder Smoke listeners will be trying to make contact with them for their special event stations. More on that as we get closer to the actual date. Althea, not a ham but a homebrewer, wrote in and talked about her interest in listening to Solder Smoke. I don't mean to be, every once in a while I refer to gentlemen or gents or something like that, and that's just because the fact is that most of the listeners are guys, but I don't want to forget the ladies who are listening in. So Althea, really glad that you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for listening. Antonio from Porto, Portugal, wrote in. Antonio wrote a couple of weeks back and talked about how he got into electronics, and he sent another very nice message, and he talks about this time about how he was led to electronics through model airplanes. And I think there's a number of us out there who made the same kind of trip. Thanks very much. Speaking of books, Andrew, G4CWX, wrote in, and he said he was very pleased to hear that Solder Smoke, the book, is available. He is a very successful author of fiction, And he's written a series of what really look to be great books, fictional books. The latest is called Killer Email. It's published by Vanguard. You can get more information on www.andrewatkinson, all one word, A-T-K-I-N-S-O-N, www.andrewatkinson.org. More information about his books. And Andrew says that his next book in the series will have an amateur radio theme. So that sounds like it'll be a lot of fun. Vanguard, very prestigious publisher. And congratulations to you, Andrew. Thanks for sharing the information. And I certainly encourage all Solder Smoke listeners to check out Andrew's books. Finally, we have a question. Gary, VK2KYP, had been listening to an earlier episode from one of the early episodes of Solder Smoke in which Mike and I were discussing TALO RF impedance meters, or a project called a TALO RF impedance meter. And I guess this was early days. We weren't that good about documenting our sources. So if anybody knows where the articles or the schematics for this project are, please let Gary know, VK2KYP. You can send me an email, and I'll pass it on to him. Guys, I've been droning on here too long. I think we're almost over the one-hour limit. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you all have a great week. The summer is getting started here. Memorial Day weekend in the States is coming up. So have a good start to the summer to everybody in the Northern Hemisphere. Hope the winter's treating you kindly down south. 7-3 from Rome.